Welcome to the first gubernatorial debate of the general election season. I'm John Dankosky from Connecticut Public Radio. I'll be moderating this debate between Democrat Ned Lamont and petitioning candidate Oz Griebel. This event is sponsored by the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges, Connecticut Public Radio, WFSB, and the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks to these organizations, thanks to the students, the faculty, and the staff of the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford for hosting us tonight. Tonight's debate is live on Connecticut Public Radio and is streaming on WFSB.com. We extended tonight an invitation to Republican Bob Stefanowski, but he declined our invitation. It is a cumulative time debate tonight, with each candidate getting 24 minutes of time to answer questions from our panelists, and those panelists are Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror and Dennis House of WFSB. The candidates will each have a one-minute closing statement after those 24 minutes are over. It's my job here to keep the conversation going, and I will occasionally jump in to move things along and ask some follow-up questions. I will ask our audience to stay quiet during the debate to allow maximum time to hear from the candidates. If you're here, turn off the ringers on your phone, of course, but we will ask you to tweet, and you can use the hashtag CCICDebate. Of course, you can tweet about this if you're watching on WFSB.com or listening on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm going to, first of all, welcome the two candidates. Thank you, Ned Lamont. Thank you, Oz Griebel, for being here.
Great to be here.
And I want to turn over to Mark Pazniokas for our first question. Paz?
Good evening. Your opponent, Bob Stefanowski, traces Connecticut's current economic problems back to passage of the income tax in 1991. So, one, do you agree with his view that there's a cause and effect relationship between the Connecticut's current economy and the income tax? And two, if not, is there one or two things that you can point to that you would do as governor early on to try to turn around our economic issues right now? Mr. Long?
And I think this first question goes to Oz Griebel.
Mark, thanks. Appreciate the question, and I will respond to it. But I want to take a couple of minutes here at the outset to do two things. One, echo the thanks to the sponsors here, and particularly to the Conference of Independent Colleges and to Rona Free and the USJ community for hosting us here tonight. And I also want to take a few of my 24 minutes to address a challenge that Monty Frank, my running mate, and I have, and that is with the name recognition. And as some of you may know, because of rules that WTNH has down in Channel 8, we're currently excluded from the September 12th and September 17th debates. And one of the reasons is we only registered 4% on the Quinnipiac poll, but within that poll, over 80% of the folks said that they didn't know enough about me to form an opinion as to whether they would support the Griebel-Frank ticket. So I've taken some time here tonight, and some of my own team says I don't talk enough about what I've done. So I'm going to take the liberty of part of my 24 minutes to give some background not only in who I am and what I've done, but more importantly about how I think. So I went to high school in North Jersey. I graduated from Dartmouth College in 1971. I taught and coached at the high school and college level, part-time and full-time, for 15 years. I went to law school at night. I joined the bank, what used to be the First National Bank of Boston, and spent 16 years in Boston in various legal and operation responsibilities. I was transferred down here to Connecticut in 1993 to oversee what was then Bank of Boston, Connecticut. I left the bank to go to McDermott, a specialty chemicals company, in 1999 to serve as its chief operating officer, and joined the Metro Hartford Alliance as its first CEO in 2001, and served in that role until last December when I left to join Monty Frank and form the Griebel-Frank 4CT ticket. I served on a board of a publicly traded company, McDermott, and I currently serve on the board of a privately held company, World Business Capital. But more importantly, that extensive business experience has contributed to and been broadened by my service here in the Hartford region and in Connecticut on a number of boards of various organizations. And they include the Bradley International Airport, the Connecticut Science Center, eHealth Connecticut, the Federal Reserve Bank's Bank of Boston's New England Advisory Council, Grace Academy, the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving, the Hartford Marathon Foundation, Mark Twain House, the University of Hartford, and Yale New Haven Hospital. And I've chaired over that time the boards of the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, the Connecticut Transportation Strategy Board, Junior Achievement of Central Connecticut, Northwest Catholic High School, Riverfront Recapture, the Bushnell Center for the Performing Arts, and annual United Way campaigns in Hartford and Waterbury. And during my tenure at the Alliance, we created a marketing campaign called Hartford, New England's Rising Star, to support the Rollins administration's $2 billion investment in the city. We've established a number of initiatives along the way, including the Hartford Business Improvement District, Hartford Young Professionals and Entrepreneurs, the Connecticut Insurance and Financial Services Cluster, and the Connecticut Health Council, all designed to focus on job growth, to compete for jobs, capital, and talent in this region. At the same time, we worked tirelessly on putting a spotlight on the fiscal policies and failures at the Capitol and in the city that have produced the looming and obscene deficit that we all face at the state level, and Hartford's equally obscene mill rate of 75 that precludes unsubsidized private investment. And all of these experiences have required convening, listening, and art of the possible skills. Skills needed to bring people with disparate backgrounds and perspectives together to achieve substantive accomplishments and at the same time to keep the spotlight on effective public policies. Most importantly, I want to salute the folks at the Alliance because those successes have been built on the diversity of experiences and backgrounds of very talented women and people of color of all ages. Our team of dedicated professionals at the Alliance created a modern workplace that balanced the needs of the organization with those of the individual.
Mr. Griebel, I mean, the ground rules were explained. There's no opening statements. You're trying to use some time.
That's why I asked the question, Mark.
Yeah, and so finish your statement, please, and we'll.
I'd
really like to get to Mark's answer.
I will get to Mark's question. That's what I said at the beginning.
Okay.
So may I finish, John?
Please.
Okay. Thank you. And our team of dedicated professionals there has created that modern workplace, and as a result, we built an agenda of accomplishments and a reputation for delivering valued and valuable service to our investors, to the Hartford region, to the I-91 corridor, and to the entire state of Connecticut. And so through these 25 years here in Connecticut, I've developed a personal reputation for action, candor, collaboration, integrity, respect for others, and a focus on the common good. And I provide this summary to illustrate that I've not only lived and worked in Connecticut for 25 years, I've worked for Connecticut for 25 years. And that breadth of experience distinguishes me very differently from all the other candidates and qualifies me uniquely to serve as your next governor. In terms of the income tax, I don't believe, Mark, at all that the income tax is at the heart of what our problem is today. I believe at the heart of our problem in the income tax is the inappropriate spending of the surplus in the 99 to 2001 period, where we ran up about $5.5 billion of surplus. The only way that under the amendment, that surplus was supposed to be spent was to be, unless it was a declared emergency by the governor and 60% of the legislature, was to be used for debt service, pension investment, or rainy day funds. We declared an emergency and only about $1.5 billion of that money went in there. To me, that was the beginning of the erosion of private sector confidence in this state to do what we said we were going to do, namely use the income tax, surpluses in the income tax for that, for their particular purpose. In terms of what I would do in the first budget, you know as well as all of this audience knows, we're looking at about a $4.5 billion deficit over that two-year period, maybe even more depending on how you want to count the federal tax changes. So the point that we would look at is trying to see where we might be able to eliminate certain taxes, the business entity tax, maybe the gift and estate tax, maybe take the personal income tax down by a percentage or two. But I do not believe that the personal income tax needs to be part of the revenue stream of this state for the long term.
Ned Lamont, would you like to tackle the question? Would you like to have Mark re-ask it for you?
No, I think I remember. Thank you very much. And President Free and St. Joseph, thank you for inviting us here this evening, and the independent colleges. I got to tell you, I spent the first 35 years of my career building telecommunication systems for colleges. So when I see an audience like this, I may switch into another mode if I don't watch myself. The problem is not the income tax. The problem is the failure of political leadership in this state going back generations. And it's failed political leadership that you're going to need a governor who has the courage to stand up and take on the entrenched interests on both sides of the aisle to make the big changes we need to get this state back on track. And I met most of you when I took on a senior member of my own party because I thought he was dead wrong about the invasion of Iraq. And I did not make my party leaders all that happy. And some years later, I thought our state was off in the wrong direction, and I took on Dan Malloy in a primary. And I thought if we nickel and dime around the edges, we're not going to solve the problem in this state. And I think you know that I'm somebody who's going to stand up and do what I think is right, and somebody who's going to take on the entrenched interests on both sides of the aisle, wherever they may fall. And the problem is that we failed to invest in education. We used to always have the greatest workforce in the world. That was our great competitive advantage. And we can't let that slip. We failed to invest in transportation. Our geographic location should be an extraordinary advantage for this state, where we are. You know, opening the Middle Atlantic states, opening New England, our ports going to Europe and beyond. And we've let that fail, and we let that be an extraordinary disadvantage for our state. We didn't invest there, and we also didn't invest in our pension funds going back 30, 40, 50 years. And that's the crux and the source of the budget crisis that confronts the state of Connecticut. But that's then and now's now. And I hope this debate focuses on what we do going forward to get this state back on track, because it's an amazing state with so many great advantages, including our university system, including our workforce, including just the quality of life we have. And you're going to make sure you have a governor that believes in the state, make you believe in the state, able to make those tough choices, get people to the table, roll up their sleeves, turn the corner, and get this state moving again.
Dennis?
I want to continue our conversation on the income tax. Bob Stefanowski, the Republican candidate who's not here tonight, is calling for the elimination of the income tax.
Right.
The Commission for Fiscal Stability and Economic Growth is recommending that it's crucial to Connecticut's future to reduce that income tax, yet neither of you are calling for a reduction in that tax. What do you say to voters who want tax relief, who want their income tax reduced or want it wiped out altogether?
Do we go in order here, John? How do we do this?
I think this next one goes to Ned Lamont.
Look, one of the leading financial reporters in the state recently called that plan to eliminate the income tax right out of La La Land. That is just a false promise, as another one of the Republican candidates said about that. And it's time you had a governor that tells you the truth, what we can do and what we can't do. And elimination of the income tax would be devastating for our schools. It would be devastating for our towns and cities. It would jack up property tax. And as a business person, I can tell you what we need more than anything else right now is fiscal stability. That's what the Fiscal Commission was all about. Get us an honestly balanced budget so we can plan going forward, 2 years, 4 years. None of this every 2 years we have another fiscal crisis. What they do, eliminating that income tax and dribs and drabs over the next 6, 8 years would just be an ongoing fiscal crisis. And I think that would be a disastrous. Look, I understand the middle class in this state is getting slammed. It's getting more and more expensive to live in the state. And everybody that leaves, I know about it. They tell me what's going on. And the most important thing we can do to send a statement to those folks that we get it. We know this is a state that's got to get its costs under control and get its budget balanced in an honest way. Is at least, as I've proposed, is a targeted property tax relief. What that means to our seniors who are stuck right now, they are on a fixed income and they tell me they can't afford to stay here as property taxes keep going up. I hear that from employers and I hear that from new folks who want to move to the state and it's too expensive. So property tax relief, I think, is one way for us to say we get it. We know this is an expensive state. And we're going to work seriously to take care of that. Property tax relief is the biggest tax that the middle class pays and makes a difference. But I cannot outpromise Bob Stefanowski when it comes to giving away taxes, giving away the inheritance tax, giving away the corporate income tax, doing it all, you know, in a pony to boot. That's just not the way it's going to work. I'm going to tell you the truth. We're going to get an honestly balanced budget. I'm going to do everything I can to hold the line on taxes, then bring down the taxes over a period of time, and my focus will be on the property tax.
Can I just ask you quickly, how do you plan to provide that targeted property tax relief specifically?
Well, our relief plan, which would provide up to eventually $700 per middle-class homeowner, is about 1% of the budget. Compared to elimination of the income tax, which you know is over 50% of our revenues, how devastating that would be. And we laid out a fairly specific ideas on what we do about that. Number one, it's shocking to me that we collect less than half of our sales tax in this state. You know, it's just because we're inept, our telecommunications systems are soft, and we are unable to collect the sales tax in many places that we ought to be able to do that. So that's one very coherent idea that allows us to pay for a property tax relief going forward and also start putting some money in place to balance our budget.
Thank you. Oz Griebel?
Dennis, in first part, I'd say that I repeat some of the things I said earlier. I believe you need to bring the rate down. I don't believe we should eliminate the personal income tax. I believe it's an equitable, so all taxes are regressive, but I think the long-term revenue solution here, the long-term revenue structure in the state has to keep it. Does the rate have to come down from the top rate to back where it was at 4.5%? Yes. And we've said that every decision that Monty and I make, starting with the budget, will be focused on, does that decision help us enhance? Does it enhance Connecticut's ability to secure 200,000 more jobs in the private sector on a net basis over the next 10 years? We've had no net job growth in this state in 30. That's part of the reason why we have the revenue problem. We raise rates, come up with new taxes instead of more people paying taxes. So the goal would be to have more people paying taxes, therefore to drive the rate down. So in the short term, we're looking at a $4.5 billion operating deficit in this biennium. That's ugly. I have no idea how we're going to be able to balance that in its entirety. We're going to have to use the rainy day fund for sure. But we're also going to have to look out for the next biennium, two or three bienniums out. We didn't get into this mess in 10 minutes, and we're not going to get out of it in 10 minutes. Some of these ideas are all poll tested ideas. You know, property tax credit, which go against the income tax, or eliminate the personal income tax. You know, if you believe some of this stuff, I'd be happy to sell you a few bridges before I leave here tonight. This is serious stuff that has to be dealt with. Honestly, so the rainy day fund, but I think we can do things, Dennis, and part of this things that came out of the commission. Could we eliminate the business entity tax? 170,000 businesses in this state pay $250 a year. I think it generates about $60 million. Could we get rid of that? Yes, and do I think that would send a signal to the private sector that we're serious about getting our house under control? I do. Could you eliminate the gift and estate tax? You know, we've got out-migration in this state for the last 20 years. Of wealthy people. We got out-migration of people of all ages and all incomes. But if one of the reasons people are leaving is because they don't want to die in Connecticut, then let's not give them a reason to stay by eliminating that. Then we'll get their personal income tax, their sales tax, their gasoline tax, their contributions to philanthropy. It's those things I think we can do at the margin, Dennis, in that first budget, and then look over time to bring the rate down. But I do not believe in the elimination of the personal income tax.
For the next question, I want to turn to two students who we have here. I believe that we have Bradford Landry and Rachel Betts, who are students at the University of St. Joseph. Thanks so much for being here, and please address your question first to Oz Griebel.
First of all, thank you guys for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
The community. My question is, what ideas do you guys have for Connecticut colleges and universities to work together better so that our graduates are well prepared for the changing needs of markets and employers?
Well, the answer I'd give you just briefly is I've always believed that there needs to be a tighter relationship between higher education and the employers. So the idea of workforce development pipelines, I think, need to be critically enhanced instead of everybody kind of going off and doing their own things. And as a governor, one of the things that would be at the top of my list would be to work with some of our major employers, as well as with the higher eds, to see where that connection can be made more tightly. We've got tremendous opportunities, as you know, down in places like Electric Boat right now and in some of our other advanced manufacturing areas that are going begging. And so how do we close that communication gap, to me, is a start. And that also has to include, I know you're talking about higher education, but we've got to bring the vo-tech schools into this opportunity where we invest some money in those as well as into the higher education component. And that's a big part of what we need to do is to bring that the alignment of the private sector employers and higher education together.
Ned?
We absolutely have to do a better job of partnering between our colleges and our major employers. I'll give you a little good news. Everybody gives you bad news in this state. We have thousands and thousands of really good-paying jobs that we cannot fill right now. We cannot fill these jobs in advanced manufacturing, as Oz said, at Electric Boat, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, teaching, nursing, the trades, because we are not training the people for these jobs. And if we do a better job of partnering business employers and our schools, we're going to make sure that these are Connecticut jobs for Connecticut families. Make sure these are good-paying jobs. As I said, we don't need more taxes. We need more taxpayers. You know, and shame on us that we don't take this opportunity. You know, it's not often in a cycle that you actually have these amazing opportunities and jobs that could be filled right now to get this state moving again. I see some of my friends here from Central Connecticut State University, where I've been an adjunct professor for many years. And I do in political science. I also teach a course on how to start your own business. And we have the business plan competition there. And I do everything I can to give young people a sense of energy and passion about what it is and how meaningful it is to start a business and what that means going forward. And I'll just say something else, since these are folks of independent colleges. When we helped bring an Infosys, an Indian IT company, to Hartford, and I was telling them, we got Votech, we got STEM, we've got all these amazing tech programs. They said, that's great, but I also want a really great liberal arts graduate who can read and think. Because over the course of a career now, your job is going to change 3 or 4 times. And that's what some of our greatest independent colleges do. That's what I'll remember every day as your governor.
Thank you so much. Our second question from our student is from Rachel. Hi.
Good evening, and thank you for being here tonight. My question for you both is, what ways do you believe you can best create jobs in Connecticut that will keep Connecticut college graduates here in the state as opposed to leaving for other opportunities?
And Ned Lamont?
Don't go. Good times are coming here. You want to stay in Connecticut. Let me tell you that. I just told you that we have tens of thousands of really great jobs. And I don't know what your major is and what you study, but we got to make sure that I have a database right there, that I have employers coming to your college, telling you what it means to do advanced manufacturing, what it means to be in the trades, what these skills are and what they mean in terms of salary and what they mean in terms of lifestyle. I've got to make people believe that this is a state where they'll be able to afford to live and they can stay close to home. I hear everywhere I go, people my age, they wonder, will my kids be able to live in Connecticut? I want to live where my kids are, and I want my kids being able to come back. That's about jobs, that's about opportunity, and making sure that you're trained for those jobs, and making sure I do everything I can to make this state affordable for our young people.
Rachel, the first thing that the governor has to do is make sure that the employers here today, who are here today, want to keep the jobs that they have here today. When I talk about 200,000 net new jobs, I mean net. Not 200,000 coming in the front door and 200,000 going out the back door, which means right now, yes, we've got some nice activity down at Electric Boat. But when you talk to a number of employers in the state, I don't care whether they're publicly traded, whether they're large, they're small, it is a concern about the tax structure, the cost of doing business in the state, the fact that they don't believe that state political leadership will solve the problems. And the only way we're going to change that attitude is be talking on a regular basis. With those employers, with the CEOs, with the business owners, to find out whether there's some things we can do to help them, the low-hanging fruit, and we begin to demonstrate how we're going to solve one of the issues we haven't talked about yet here tonight. How are we going to solve this unfunded retirement problem that's staring us in the face? We need to reignite confidence in business owners, in business leaders, so that the jobs that are here today stay here, and that the next job they add is added here in Connecticut and not in New Hampshire or South Carolina.
Thank you both for your questions.
You
and just a reminder, this is a cumulative time debate, and we're flying through the time right now. So we've got a lot of questions we want to get to. We may move things along fairly quickly. The next question first goes to Oz Griebel, and Mark Pazniokas has it.
It's a question to Oz, but it actually refers to something that happened with Mr. Lamont on a FM radio station in Bay. You were asked a yes or no question. Would you raise taxes? And you said, yes. I'm not going to ask either of you a yes or no question about raising taxes, but I will ask you, looking ahead to the challenges, to the $2 billion deficit, as you sit here tonight, do you anticipate having to raise taxes? And if so, which ones would be the ones that you would see as fairest way to balance the next budget and close that $2 billion deficit? Oz?
Mark, you know, you're going to take the pledge. Am I going to say I'm not going to raise taxes? You're sitting here looking at a $4.5 to $5 billion operating deficit that is going to be balanced probably again in part on further cuts to municipal aid and some other horrible things like that that are on the horizon. We're going to have to take all of the rainy day fund to at least mitigate some of that $4.5 billion issue.
In the first year, you would take the entire rainy day fund?
Well, you're looking at, in the first year, you're looking at $2.5 billion. So, I mean, my question is, you know, there are no easy answers here, Mark. You know this every well as I do. And so the notion of how you're going to get at this, to me, is I do think we need, as I said in the answer to Dennis's question, take a look at where we might be able to eliminate some relatively minor taxes to send the right signal. Now, that means you got to find the offset either in an additional tax or in a cost saving. So you will look at all that. Look, the idea that we raise taxes, this goes back to something that the Commission on Fiscal Stability, I think, did the wrong recommendation. The idea that we'd lower the income tax but put a payroll tax in. And the theory is that was going to give a break to the subchapter S owners, but that would be offset by the payroll tax. Well, a publicly traded company gets no benefit from that. So the UTCs and the EBs and the Hartfords of the world aren't going to get any benefit from that. So the notion if you're asking me what taxes would I raise, I would look at it in the context of how bad the budget is at that point.
Well, I guess the issue we're trying to get at is, can you give the voters a sense of what you think is the fairest way to raise revenue if indeed you need to go that way next January and February?
Yeah, I don't know how I could possibly answer that question without looking at what the dynamic is. I mean, the notion that you're going to raise a tax when you know that the likely impact, depending on which tax you raise, is going to lead to more out-migration, to no job growth here, that to me is a serious. So where do you look to reduce expenses is where I would go first. The idea of, you know, could you take the municipal aid and direct some of that to councils of governments to give them an incentive to get at regional delivery of municipal services? Because we all know that one of the big costs of living in the state, it's not just state taxes, it is the property tax. And it's particularly the property tax by business that has to pay it on facilities and on equipment. So raising more taxes, to me, is an anathema given the structure that we have. And I would look first and foremost to reduce costs.
And we'll turn to Ned Lamont, and maybe as you answer, you can explain a bit about what you did say on FM radio and what you mean about raising taxes or not here in the state.
I think we have to convince the people of Connecticut and the taxpayers of Connecticut that their money is being well spent and focused on investments in our future, investments in everything we do to get this state going and growing again. And we have to do a lot to earn their respect right now, because they think a lot of their money is being wasted. And you know what? A lot of their money is being wasted. So I first and foremost have to bring my sharp pencil as a small business guy to a lot of the budgets we have there. I have, as Oz said, look, there's a lot of significant structural savings that we can do. The problem with not being, look, we left this to the legislature for the last couple of cycles. What a legislature can do is line item out this or raise that rate a little bit, and that's no way to solve what we got to do here. We have to make significant changes in our delivery of health care. That would represent real savings going forward. You look in terms of our shared services going forward. Look, I love the fact that our feisty independence, we have 169 towns, but that doesn't mean you need 169 taxpayers. That is costing us a fortune. We're one of the very few states in the country that has more administrators than we have teachers in the classroom. So I have to start with that as a premise. Then I think, as Oz said, I look in terms of a tax structure that gives us the reliable predictability and is fair going forward in terms of what we got to do. Look, I've heard the ad on TV. It, you know, slams me pretty hard. You know, Lamont is a tax raiser. You're going to raise taxes on your cars. No, just the opposite. You know, I was voicing an idea that, look, if we had a equalized statewide tax on automobiles, why is it that Ansonia pays four or five times more for their Toyota than they do in Greenwich? I think that's a way that I can equalize things. I can raise some money, but yeah, it'd be a tax on a few of my friends further down.
When you said yes on that radio show, did you have a tax in mind?
I thought about tolling. I thought about the fact that our big tractor trailer trucks, almost all of which come in from out of state, by the way, are tearing up our roads, tearing up our bridges, and we're barely getting by in terms of our transportation fund. Look, everybody here gives you wonderful speeches about transportation, how investment's got to be so key to our future. Well, you might as well come up with a couple of ways to pay for it. And right now, all I hear from the Republicans is they're going to borrow more to pay for transportation. And that's just the mindset that got us into this mess over the last 20 years.
You just said something, though, about your friends down there. Is there some expectation that we can expect to see a higher tax rate on higher income earners during a Lamont administration?
Look, I'm going to do everything I can to hold the rate steady. I can see expanding the base. I can tell you what I did in terms of electronic tolling on those big tractor trailer trucks is the way to think about that. But I'm not looking to raise anybody's rates right now. I think we can do it. I think I can do it through a good, hard negotiation, some real economies, and that's what I mean to do.
Dennis House?
Our next question is something that Mr. Lamont had touched on earlier. Two members of the Commission for Fiscal Stability and Economic Growth run Face the State this past weekend and said almost half of the potential sales tax revenue in our state is never collected. As governor, Tell us about the specific system you would put into place to collect all of the taxes that are due the state.
Yeah, remember that the sales tax used to raise most of our operating, and it's been diminishing as a source of revenue for this state for a lot of reasons, one of which is I referred to earlier, you just said, is we're lousy at collecting. And we got to do a better job of collecting what is due. I think it's only fair to those that pay that sales tax, the others can do it as well. And I think there are a lot of new softwares and electronic ways we'll be able to do that without being intrusive for small business. I've said a lot about the fact that most of our GDP is exempt from the sales tax. I say, for example, e-commerce in the digital economy. And it's fundamentally unfair to your Main Street businesses. Those guys that have to collect the sales tax when they sell you a product, and that big out-of-state internet retailer does not. And I think that's a source of revenue, but more importantly, it's also a fair way that we can raise revenues and allow our Main Street businesses to compete. You know, and when I talk about doing everything I can to reduce the property tax, that's another way to help our Main Street businesses compete. And they pay the property tax.
Dennis, I have not looked at the systems issues. I've talked to a few vendors who've been in this business saying we could do better. I've not really delved into it. I would need to be better educated on how mechanically, systems-wide, we would need to collect it. Now, obviously, the issues around Amazon and all the things that happened today that undermine the smaller business, not just the retailers, but across the board, is something that needs to be looked at. I think it's a federal issue. How much we influence that, I need to be better educated on. But clearly, anything we can do and to use the technology we have today to collect more sales tax makes all the sense in the world.
Mark Pazniokas?
There are about 100 million Americans who have arrest records in the United States. There are actually more Americans with criminal records than who have four-year college degrees. Under the age of 23, I should say, I think that is. So Connecticut's one of about 20 states that has what's called ban the box. You know, you can't right. ask certain questions up front about criminal right. background. So my question is, would you have signed that legislation? That's one thing. And two, are there other policies you have in mind about improving second chances for people who have criminal records?
Absolutely. It's a great question, Mark. I think it's at the heart of a number of things, both in terms of addressing our workforce development needs, but also to provide people with a genuine second chance. So I would sign the Ban the Box legislation. I think it gives its the employer still has the opportunity to probe after that initial submission. But you ask a question that I think is broader than that, and building off of some of the things that the Malloy administration has done with the second chance programs, bringing and what Commissioner Semple has done in the corrections area, of bringing some training into the prison system to begin to prepare people to be ready when they come out. The idea of using some of our apprenticeship programs in a way, with down in Bridgeport at the Housatonic Advanced Manufacturing Center, and some of the things there where a lot of their students are individuals who have been released on parole who are looking for that second chance opportunity, giving them the skills that they need to take advantage of some of these job openings. I think all of that has to be part of a much more enlightened, you know, building off of the recent years, a much more enlightened approach to not only how do we make sure that someone going back on the street with no job and the incidence of recidivism are so high, if we don't do something like that, we keep, you know, it's a kind of pay me now, pay me later. But the idea of being respect for the individual, giving people an individual a second chance, has to be at the heart of any administration if we want to move Connecticut back to preeminence on a whole bunch of fronts.
I agree. I mean, this has been a remarkable success for our state and for a lot of folks who got a second chance. We have a third fewer people incarcerated today than we had 7 or 8 years ago. And our recidivism rate, as Oz just said, is down because we give these guys training, we give them an opportunity, we give them hope. You know, the labor unions have a set aside for folks with a second chance. They're up there rebuilding Weaver High School in Hartford as we speak right now. And as a taxpayer, you should also know that you're not only giving folks a second chance who deserve a second chance, provided they keep to the straight and true and narrow, which they have and they do, but it's saving us hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars compared to the mass incarceration. I mean, incarceration was the fastest growing piece of our budget just 20 plus years ago. So this is something I'd be careful about going forward. There's a certain point that you can go beyond, but I'd carefully keep going. And I think it's so important that we get our community colleges involved there. So when you leave incarceration, often as a young person who made some stupid mistake at the age of 20, they have an opportunity to get back on their feet, and most of them do with real success. And like I said, our crime rate is at a real historic low, so let's keep it going.
And Mark, I just a quick thing, just to come back a second answer. I think the preventative issues like the PAL programs here in the city of Hartford, where the police are involved in a early on basis so that someone doesn't get arrested, someone doesn't get incarcerated, the whole system of how you tie public education into that, it's got to be a comprehensive look at this, not simply slicing off the second chance by itself. It does have to look what happens in our urban school districts. Where do we provide safety? Where do we provide support for those young people? That has to be part of the discussion as well as the second chance component.
Thanks so much. Dennis?
The Hartford Business Journal is reporting this week that every month construction of the proposed Foxwoods Mohegan Casino in East Windsor is delayed. It means an extra $10 million goes to MGM in Springfield. This Springfield Casino is a relatively new concept. It's a downtown casino where visitors are expected to visit the already existing restaurants and attractions. It's also on the new Hartford Line, Hartford to Rail Service.
Right.
Should the state consider something like that for Bridgeport or Hartford for our third casino rather than a standalone one in Windsor?
This goes to Windsor. Lamont, yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's to Ned.
Yeah, I think it's to me. Hey, look, I'm talking about jobs, opportunity, growth, getting the state moving again. And on my list of priorities, another casino is pretty far down that list. That said, my God, if I got a private business that wants to invest $700-800 million into the waterfront in Bridgeport, I'd take a look at it. I could see an open process. And I wonder about an open process. I think maybe we need a commission. We're doing this so ad hoc. Hey, let's give them something in East Windsor. Let's figure, I think we need a strategy and a process going forward. But at the end of the day, I think we ought to have an open process and we see what's in the best interest of the state of Connecticut there, be it East Windsor or East Windsor and something in Bridgeport as well. And, I spent a little time with Joe Ganim over the last 4 months and I kept saying, stop calling it a casino. Call it a resort, and maybe we can get a little bit of progress.
Can I just follow up? You have spent a lot of time with Joe Ganim, and you've spent a lot of time in Bridgeport, too. Is a casino in Bridgeport a good idea?
I would have an open process, an honest process, probably with a gambling commission made up of strong, independent-minded citizens.
But do you think it's a good idea?
I mean, and I would allow that to go forward.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Oscar?
The idea of a casino in Bridgeport or in South Windsor, we still have the issue, as far as I know, of trying to resolve the revenue from the two tribes. That's a big deal for us, and that also applies to the sports betting issue. So where that stands, as far as I know, there is no ongoing negotiation between the Malloy administration, at least active, and the two tribes. If we don't get that issue resolved, then the idea of putting another casino anywhere, I think, is troubling. We get that issue resolved, and if it's an open process and private sector money wants to come into Bridgeport, fine. I don't think state money should go into it. And one big question I would have around Bridgeport is the impact it would have on transportation. How are we going to get people, if we're going to drive the kinds of crowds that we would expect to generate the tax revenues associated with a casino, how are we going to address what's already a very unsatisfactory transportation issue, both in terms of trains and I-95 congestion? So are we going to have more ferry service coming in from New York? I don't know that, but that would be a question that as the governor on a policy matter, I think has to be part of the long-term discussion of any casino in Bridgeport.
It was a failure of leadership. I agree with you. I mean, I would have had the tribes. I would have had MGM in there. I would have said, look, this could be a transportation bottleneck. What does this mean for the Bridgeport rail station, which would be a short walk to what they're talking about? What does that mean in terms of ferry service? So people can come to Long Island, so they can come down to New York and back and forth. How do you relieve the congestion on I-95? I think it's been a lost opportunity. I get it on track.
Mark?
Well, let's talk about leadership and economic development and money that gets invested into the private sector. This governor has borrowed heavily to finance his first five program,
right,
which is intended to entice major employers to expand in Connecticut. So let me ask you about two two deals that are probably the two marquee deals that Governor Malloy has done. One is the package to keep Sikorsky here to make sure their next generation of heavy lift helicopters is built in Stratford. And the other one is very different, to attract the Jackson Labs here, to have genomic medicine and genomic research, you know, a key part of the campus out in Farmington. Would you two have done those deals? Are those good investments?
Oz Griebel?
The Sikorsky deal, I'm not as familiar with the details on, Mark, but I am pretty familiar with the Jackson Labs one, so I'd like to tee that one up. I think the Jackson Labs investment was a very intelligent investment for the state. But what we didn't take advantage of, going back to the UConn Health Center, is we didn't take advantage of bringing that into downtown Hartford. You may remember that John McKinney, when he was Senate Minority Leader, said that the failure to deal with that on a combined basis was the wasted urban redevelopment effort. Had we taken a look at the, this is where it drives us all crazy. We look at things vertically. We take one piece and say, let's talk about Jackson Labs. But the real issue is the Connecticut Health Center and the amount of money that went into the health center. Not that I begrudge anybody, you know, the hospitals out there, but look at the vibrant health system we already have here in Hartford between St. Francis and Hartford Hospital and Connecticut Children's Medical Center. Had we taken some of that money and created a Cleveland Clinic type approach in downtown Hartford with Jackson Labs, I think it would have been, you know, whatever's above a home run, a grand slam. You know, you're Babe Ruth or Barry Bonds of economic development. That would have had a huge impact on the city and the region overall. And this gets back a little bit into the whole notion of regional delivery and municipal services. Why do we do this? Well, you got towns fighting against one another for the associated tax revenue. There should have been a way to bring that together to benefit the region. The one point I want to make to you, though, Mark, I do not believe, as a general matter, that investing on the First Five program is the right use of taxpayer money. It does. It has government betting on winners and losers. It irritates people who don't get the money, who've been here for maybe 150 years, but they didn't get the benefit of it because they didn't threaten to leave. So to me, investing in transportation, investing in education, so that everybody benefits from that, investing in apprenticeship programs, that's where I believe the best use of taxpayer dollars go for true economic development.
Just very quickly, what do you do about the fact that nearby states are throwing these same sorts of incentives right at these same companies? I mean, I think any governor would probably face a lot of criticism, as this one does,
right,
if a company goes elsewhere.
John, I just think when you look at the tax, we are within spitting distance of New York and Boston. We don't have to recruit anybody from California or Texas. Our cost structure here, even though we're talking about the high cost of living in the state, it beats Greater Boston inside 128. It beats Greater Manhattan. Look at the cost of living of young people in Brooklyn today that 20 years ago was very different. We should be able to position ourselves by looking at demonstrating we're going to get our costs under control, demonstrating we're going to get our unfunded pension liabilities under control. That, to me, is what we need to demonstrate what the private sector really wants to see.
Thank you, Ned.
I'd be very cautious about throwing out these incentives like the First Five program and having politics pick winners and losers and having the state do the next Cleveland Clinic. I'll tell you, I was negotiating hard with Infosys, and they told me something, that's the IT company that's moving to Hartford. And they said, I liked what Rhode Island said. Rhode Island said, Infosys, Rhode Island said, we'll match anything Connecticut offers. Now let me tell you why you ought to be in Rhode Island. And we've relied too much on these one-off incentives and one-off tax giveaways instead of paying attention to the fundamental reasons that people ought to be in the state of Connecticut. And one of the reasons they ought to be in the state of Connecticut is we have the best trained, most productive workforce in the world. And that was one of the reasons that GE told us they were leaving. They couldn't recruit those people. That was one of the reasons that Aetna said they're going. They can't find the next generation of talent. And that's one of the reasons I thought it was so important to get Infosys there to Hartford, training 1,000 IT specialists every year once they get going. Let's work on our advantages, leverage where we have our strengths. That plus transportation. Look, I'm not going to go in with an arm tied behind my back and say I'm never going to provide an incentive, but fundamentally, I'm going to fix the transportation system, balance our budget, and get our education system where it wants to be so I don't have to rely upon these bribes.
Just very quickly, because we're running low on time, Sikorsky, Jackson Labs, were those good deals for the state?
I would have been pretty careful on Jackson Labs and where they wanted to be. Sikorsky is, although it's a win for our state. Did we overpay? I can't get into that. Sikorsky is an anchor tenant for this state, what it means in terms of good paying, middle-class jobs that is core to our place. So I want to be a good partner. But I'll tell you one thing as a governor. I was just shocked that we found out that Mass Mutual was leaving by reading in the newspaper. We found out that Alexion was leaving New Haven by reading in the newspaper. You want to have a governor who's a champion for the state. One of that means is knowing these CEOs, knowing who they are, knowing what makes them tick, knowing what's important to them, knowing why they want to be involved in a job training program at CCSU or St. Joseph's.
You know what your answer says to me, though, is maybe the state should be investing in newspapers. Thank you. I'm here all week. Dennis House has the next question. And again, we are running a little low on cumulative time. We'll get updates for you in just a moment. Dennis,
go ahead. Quick with the question. Another recommendation of the Fiscal Commission is a full-time legislature because they believe our current system of creating a budget is archaic. What are your feelings in making the legislature full-time and year-round?
I think this one goes to Ned.
Mr. Lamont.
I don't know. That may be more time for mischief as far as I'm concerned. hey, look, I mean, Texas, the legislature meets every other year, and they're adding jobs. I would be careful. I would say, look, I think the leadership in the legislature, the committee heads, I want them there. I want them paid to do their job. I want them better informed. I mean, my God, they didn't even know about the Hartford deal they were voting on a while ago. They all seemed clueless. So I would start with that. When it comes to the full-time legislature, I don't think I'm there at this point. Maybe they spend a little less time there, and that's a way, you know, they can also keep a real private sector existence going that's for real. I think it's tough to do it when you're on 3 months and then 6 months every other year. That's a pretty complicated way to live your life.
I don't believe in a full-time legislature at this juncture, Dennis, because your costs would go out of sight. The only way that you could ever have a serious conversation is whether we could shrink the legislature. There was some discussion about that several years ago, never went anywhere, but I would never support a full-time legislature with 170, 80, whatever the numbers are we have to get. It makes no sense to me when you're trying to talk about how we're going to get costs under control. I do believe we need to have serious discussions with members of the legislature about, you know, should a member of the legislature get any kind of a retirement plan? Should it just be a straight 401k? I mean, we have people who stay in the legislature in part to make sure they get a pension benefit and in part that they get health care coverage for life. Those are not the right incentives, in my opinion, to run for public office. So taking a look at those and working with the legislature, you know, I'm sure I'd be welcome with open arms when they come in with this idea. But the idea that you would say, look, we're going to go to a 401k plan, you're not going to get lifetime coverage for health care for you and your spouse, that has to change. If we don't change that, we're not going to get the kind of structural difference, and you're not going to earn the confidence of the private sector. I mean, it's almost, when you think about it, the full-time legislature is the antithesis of what we need today.
Let me follow on something I said. I mean, if I was starting with a blank piece of paper, one of the real problems we've got in this state is cities versus suburbs, suburbs versus town, this sort of conflict. If we had a smaller legislature where those state senators or legislators had a body that included the city as well as the suburbs as well as some of those towns, so they had a broader perspective, that would help us drive a certain agenda and build a certain consensus going forward. The other thing the Fiscal Commission said I thought made a heck of a lot of sense is you got a finance committee, you got an appropriations committee, you know, one guy spends, one guy figures out how to pay for it. Put those together in one committee. So we actually have one group that I can deal with as your governor that can figure out here's the spending, here's how we pay for it, and put that together as a strategy going forward. And the leverage, one other thing, it's beyond me why legislators can throw their mileage into their pension calculation. That's going to stop in my time.
Mark Pazniokas, we've got time for a couple more questions. Go ahead.
Sure. I'm going to ask you a question that I actually asked at a Republican debate, but since Mr. Stefanowski is not here, I'll ask you two gentlemen.
You had noticed that.
I just did. I did. it's about housing and segregation. And yes, segregation is still an issue in Connecticut.
Correct.
Only 20 of Connecticut's 169 cities and towns allow multifamily housing as a matter of right under their zoning regs. And by the way, multifamily housing, we're not talking about big complexes. It's, you know, three units or more. So the question is, there was a bill that failed that would have put pressure on the communities that currently don't allow any multifamily housing. And obviously, when the legislature involving itself in local zoning is always
right.
a fun topic. But how do you two feel about that? Is this something the state should lean on these cities and towns and to say, you know, you got to knock it off. You have to open your doors to more affordable housing to allow, at the very least, three-family housing.
Is this 83G, or I forget what the name, is that the statute you're referring to, the modification to it?
I'm blanking on the names. There are a couple of laws out there that apply.
Right, so the idea...
go ahead.
Yeah, so the notion of segregation is a very serious one, Mark. The idea of trying to force a town to do something that's going to come back, I'm not sure is the right way to go. I think the emphasis has to be on making sure that our urban school districts, which is what part of this issue is about, are appropriately supported, so that the children in those schools are going to the gap of performance gap gets shrunk dramatically. The segregation in the Hartford Public Schools, I think, is actually worse today than it was 20 years ago. When you look at the schools that are going to be closed in Hartford, the poorer performing schools are more segregated, not just based on race, but based on economic condition. On housing, I do think there's some great opportunities around transit-oriented development, both at train stations and on the busway, which is one of the reasons the busway was built to begin with. So to me, the idea of getting people close to work, where they're close to public transportation, to me is far more important in providing people a genuine opportunity to move their and their families' livelihoods forward.
Yeah, I think I follow that as well. Affordable housing is a matter of rights, diversity. It's probably one of the most important social programs there is. When it comes to, once you get that, a place where you can stay, that's an address, that's credit, that's a bus stop for your kid. And as I go around the state, which I do quite a bit these days, you just realize how important that is. I would make as a priority, though, transit-oriented development, because most of these folks can't get around. They don't have a car. The bus service may be inadequate. And I would do everything I could to make our major cities transportation hubs with more frequent regular rail service, with housing near there, and a great community school that they can call their own. And I can sell that to employers and say, you don't want to build your next factory out there in that open space, probably right closer to the city is where your advanced manufacturing ought to be, where your folks will be able to get to work very easy and very quickly. So for me, it's more broadly part of an economic development strategy as well.
Well, okay, just to be clear, so neither one of you, I take it, then would pressure these communities either by seeking a change in the law or by the threat of withholding aid to get them to open their zoning?
I prefer using incentives rather than threats.
I would agree. Mark, I won't just repeat what I said earlier.
Dennis? And Oscar, you've got about 2 minutes and 24
yes,
seconds.
I think
Ned has a little bit more time left. So this next question, I think,
I know that Mark gets his revenge now.
it goes first to Ned. Go ahead, please, Dennis.
There are likely people out there watching tonight, perhaps even in this crowd, who are considering a move out of state, perhaps to Florida, to save money on taxes. Right. How do you persuade them to hang on a little bit until you can fix things? How will their lives improve under Governor Lamont or Governor Griebel? And the big question is, when will their lives be better? 2020, 2022, when will it happen?
The most important thing I can do as your next governor is fix this fiscal situation. Make the structural reforms so you have an honest budget, that business knows what they can bet on, so that schools know and mayors know what their budget's going to be and they can plan accordingly, so that you can build a budget, invest, and grow accordingly. And that is what I am going to do. And I think this is a state with amazing opportunities going forward. We have great anchor tenants as our businesses, and they are growing and they are expanding. We have a wonderful university system and great K-12 in so many of our schools, and I'm going to focus on education and make sure that each and every one of our kids in tough districts as well as other districts have that very best opportunity. And we need them, by the way. We need you here. Don't go anywhere. We're running out of people. A lot of our workers are retiring. I'm going to do everything I can to recruit and keep those folks here in the state right now.
Will their lives be better in 2 years? 2 years into your term? Will they be paying less?
Here's the deal. I can't solve this thing in a year, I can't solve it in 2 years, but I can tell you that you're going to know where we're going. I can tell you that you're going to have an idea where the state is. You're going to know what this budget's going to be like 2 years and 4 years out. Transportation is going to be a long-term project. But what Jim Laurie from Stanley Black & Decker wants to know is, what is our transportation system going to look like in 10, 20 years? And do I want to be here, and do I want to plan accordingly going forward? When it comes to young families, they want to say, is this a place where I can afford to be? Is it going in the right direction, or is it going in the wrong direction? What I promise you is, in the near term, you're going to know we're heading in the right direction again.
Dennis, it's about leadership, and I would say to anybody, that's why I went into that long peroration at the beginning, to let people know how I've worked in the state, how I've worked for the state, and that it's not a trust me situation. Look at the record. Look at how we brought people together from disparate backgrounds with different perspectives to move things forward. Independent governor can bring leadership from both the Republican and Democratic parties together, not have them fight and stay in their corners. We can bring them together with the private sector leaders here and take advantage of the extraordinary intellectual capital that's here. So whether it gets better in 2 years, 10 years, or 20 years, Dennis, it's about sending a signal to the voters who are here today that this is a leadership team, Monty, Frank, and I, that are focused on working together for the betterment of the state, for the residents, for the taxpayers, for the employers, not to figure out whether there are more R's or D's in the legislative chamber or whose idea gets credit for it. That's a big difference. And you have to demonstrate to people that that's what this leadership, that's what this team is about, and that's why I'd say stay. Because if you stay here, we're headed in the right direction.
We're closing in on time. Ned Lamont, because you have a little bit more time left, I have to ask you a quick follow-up question. You said something earlier about how people here might feel as though a lot of their money is being wasted at the Capitol. What do you mean? Where do we waste our money specifically, and on what?
Oh, my God. As I pointed out, with 169 towns, I think there's a significant savings as we rationalize that.
And I'll just say, that's more structural, but I mean, is there money being wasted specifically by the legislature, the way we govern at the Capitol?
No, I think strategically we're not making the big decisions we need to get our expenses under control. It's not a matter of a line item here or this department is vastly overspending. It's a matter of how we deliver our services. Look, we're still locked in the 1990s. You wouldn't believe the technology in the state. You want to know why people wait in the multiple lines at a DMV? That's because one computer doesn't talk to each other. I'm afraid I said some years ago that a lot of people walk into DMV a Democrat and leave a Republican. They're so disgusted with the government when they see that. I've got to do a job if I believe in government, believe in making a difference, that I can make this work. And people say DMV, also it's Department of Social Services. These people are waiting in line hours for SNAP, food stamps. Oh, then they go in another two-hour line for Medicaid, or they have a quick question. It's just ridiculous how backward a lot of our processes are.
Oz, would you like to pick up on that with a little bit of time left? I mean, where do you think the state is wasting money right now that it could save money?
It's clearly the promises we've made on the retirement side and not funded it. That's the single biggest issue that's out there we haven't talked a lot about in this discussion. It is the big gorilla in the room.
We have time, I believe, for each of you to have a one-minute closing statement. And I'll start, if we could, with Ned Lamont.
I think you've got to believe in this state like I believe in this state. And you've heard from both of us that we're going to have a lot of tough negotiations going forward. I'm very different than what you've seen for the last 8 years. I come from the private sector where people aren't Republicans or Democrats. We get the job done. We're measured not by our promises, but by our results. I have an open door strategy, and that open door means I'm better when you're in the room. And I've said that to business, and I've said that to labor. And I've said to labor, I believe in collective bargaining, but that also includes bargaining. You're going to have to be at the table. We're going to have to negotiate our way this so we can get a budget that's honestly balanced, that doesn't borrow from the future, but invests in the future. And that's why young people are going to stay, and that's why businesses are going to expand. I'd like to say one other thing. I'm happy to be here with Oz. He and I have done a lot of bipartisan work at different colleges and working on the issues. He's focused on this, and give him 10%, but not out of my share. But I wouldn't mind seeing him around. And
thank you, Mr.
We're running
Lamont.
Against the guy that won't even show up. So well, thanks for being here, Oz.
Thank you for your final statement. Oz Griebel, a quick closing statement, if you would.
Yeah, I'd want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. I hope you've learned a lot about my experiences and the way I think and what Monty Frank and I have been to this table. We are different than Ned. I appreciate the compliment, but I want to be really clear. A lot of the things that both Bob and Ned have done have been poll tested. They've been things that are red meat issues that are going to get you all excited.